This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Tired of not getting a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
From NPR, it's been a minute. I'm Elise Hu in for Sam Sanders, and I tell ya, it cannot be easy to steal scenes from Emmy Award-winning actor and former Saturday Night Live star Bill Hader. But that's exactly what Anthony Carrigan does.
Hey, man, you must be Betty. I'm NoHo Hank.
Carrigan is the man who plays NoHo Hank, the lovable bad guy on HBO's Barry. It's about a hitman, played by Hader, who wants to turn straight by becoming an actor. NoHo Hank is a Chechen mobster who, yes, does get involved in torture and threats and extortion. He looks the part, too, bald, covered in tattoos. But Hank is also unflappably positive.
Hey, man. Are you seeing this beautiful morning?
Even when Barry tries to kill him and his fellow henchmen.
You know, buddy, I have to be honest. I'm quite a bit angry, but I'm going to put that aside for now because rage is counterproductive, yes? And I know, if the situation were reversed, I probably would have done the same thing you did.
You did do what I did. You tried to kill me.
Okay, well, now we're getting a little he said, she said.
Critics raved about Anthony Carrigan's breakout performance in season one of the show, and season two of Barry just premiered on HBO. Anthony also stars as the villain Victor Zsasz on Gotham. We sat down at NPR here in Culver City to talk about his journey, the difference between fame and success, the challenges he's faced because of his appearance, and how he's found empathy for villains after playing so many charismatic criminals. I read that you got married last year. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And your wife is of Eastern European descent?
Yes, she's from Serbia.
So can she help you with your accent? Does she help you with your accent?
I mean, yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, her accent's very different from, from
Chechnyan.
From Chechnyan. She's a professional chess player.
Whoa.
She used to be. She's kind of, figuring out what she wants to do next, but it's like, she's a pro chess player. And
do you play chess?
Beautiful. I try. It's a wonderful game. I feel like it's very overwhelming. But actually, one of the fascinating things that I've learned playing chess is that the way you play chess is kind of like the way you live your life.
Huh.
Right? It's a huge indicator of the choices that you make, of how you feel about yourself, of how you kind of make decisions. For me, for instance, I get very overwhelmed because there's so many options.
Okay.
So I tend to kind of like shut down. So it's actually good, and it's funny because the more I play chess and the more I force myself to like make those decisions, the better I am doing that in my life, weirdly.
And how does she play chess, and how is that indicative of your wife's personality?
Well, she plays chess like a genius. So
she is a genius.
So she is a genius in life. And so I really kind of look up to her in all regards, actually.
How did y'all meet?
We met on the subway in New York.
No way.
Yeah, way. Totally. And not in a creepy way. I mean, I wasn't like, hey, what's up? Yeah, do you take this train a lot? No, it was it was really funny. It was the summer solstice a few years ago, and it was the hottest day of the year.
Okay.
And so I was waiting for the train, and I see this beautiful, beautiful woman, and I'm like, oh, wow, she's gorgeous, and I kind of stop paying attention. I get on the train, and then at the next stop, I get out, and I'm, making my way to the exit, and then I realize that I got off on the wrong stop, because I wasn't paying attention.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, it's too hot. It's too hot to walk, like, those 10 blocks. I'll wait for the next train. And I turn around, and she's still standing there on the subway platform.
She had gotten off, too.
Yeah, she got off, too. And apparently, so she had gotten on the wrong train. She got on the F train.
Wow.
She was supposed to be on the M train. So she got off to wait for the next one. And we're the only two people on the subway platform.
It's kismet.
So I was like, I got to go talk to her. So I essentially went up to her, and I was like, I got off on the wrong stop.
That was your opener.
You? Yeah, I was like, yeah, I messed up. You know, I was just very.
I've embarrassed myself.
What about you? And she was like, yeah, me too. So we started talking, and then yeah, I got a number by the next stop. So whatever.
And oh then, my gosh.
Yeah, it was really lovely.
Except you don't play chess together.
I love playing chess with her. It used to be really hard for me because it was just like so overwhelming, that game. But I've improved. Yeah, I think I've improved.
That's fantastic. And you can probably teach people on set because there's a lot of waiting around on sets from what I understand.
Oh, there's a ton of waiting around
on set.
But
are there enough cerebral people to sit down and...
I think so. I bet, I'm sure...
Bill Hader.
I'm sure Bill Hader would be, you know, fantastic at chess.
And then I have to ask you, there's tattoos all over NoHo Hank's body and some on his knuckles. Yeah. What do the knuckle tattoos say?
So the knuckle tattoo, okay, so they're all kind of like prison tattoos.
Okay.
Which is like, we have to be, you know, very careful because like real prison tattoos, you know, can
you don't want
get
to
you in big trouble.
Signal anything.
Right. So they're kind of on the fringe, let's say. But the knuckle tattoos are actually chess pieces.
Oh, and that's a nod to your wife?
Mm-hmm.
I love it.
Yeah, they're chess pieces, and, you know, it's a kind of representative of, like, always, you know, always trying to stay one step ahead of your enemy.
For folks who don't know NoHo Hank, he is a villain, a Chechen mobster with a heart of gold.
Yes.
To me, how would you describe him?
I would describe him, yeah, very much like that. I think it's this crazy kind of juxtaposition because he's obviously a gangster, a Chechen gangster, but he's also, you know, in like super tight pants, polo shirts, and he's just, you know, very optimistic and lighthearted.
He offers juice boxes. He sends Bitmoji.
He loves catering to people. I mean, he's just a people pleaser, you know, and that can make things difficult when you have to work in crime.
How'd you get the part?
The cool thing was that I actually only went in one time. The stressful thing about being an actor is like you have to kind of audition again and again and again. You know, you go in one time and you go in again for a director and then again for producers,
mm-hmm.
and then again and again and again. And even at the table read sometimes, you can get cast out of the table. You can get, you know, fired from a table read.
Wow.
Reading because it's, you know, I don't know. It's that
the chemistry's
intense.
Not there. Or...
Yeah, or you first, you know, so everyone's really stressing out all the time. But I went in once and they sent my tape off to Bill and Alec, and so that was great. And then Bill called me after my audition and he was like, dude, that was so great. And oh man, when you said this line, that was so funny. And dude, the way you did this was great. And so he kept on saying this stuff. And in the back of my mind, I was like, okay, I'm going to have to do this again. Like, I'm going to have to go in and audition again. And the more you tell someone what they did right, the more you're in your head about it. And you know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. like, if I were to say, like, you remember that joke that you did? And, you know, just do it again. And be that, you know, you remember when you were hilarious? Just do that. And it's awful. It completely ruins you. So, you know, so it was nice to just kind of have, like, one and done.
I'm so glad you're sharing this side of it because I wrote to Alec last night.
Yeah.
Alec Berg, the showrunner, and I asked him about your audition.
Oh, nice.
And he wrote me this.
Oh, cool.
A little surprise for you. The thing that we noticed right away was how he listened. It's a good lesson for actors. The way he read his lines was awesome, but the way he listened when he wasn't speaking, how he clearly cared and was interested in what Barry had to say, that's what we loved. He owns that character entirely. He understands who he is and what he wants. He shows up prepared, knows his lines, but has thoughts about what else could happen. When you throw something new at him, he's so versed in the character that he can immediately take whatever you give him and make it work. That's from Alec Berg.
Wow. Wow. Choked up. No, I mean, that's so sweet.
He is actually choked up, y'all. I mean, we're on radio, so you can't see, but...
I'm at least bright red. That's that's for sure.
No.
Maybe sweating, you know, I don't know.
It is a lot of life that you bring to that character. And it turns out Bill Hader, we should talk a little bit about Bill Hader, because it turns out he's an amazing actor, which a lot of folks didn't know.
It's so funny how people didn't know that. I mean, like, I knew instantly from watching him on SNL, like, I was like, oh, this guy can do anything.
Huh.
You know, it just, there's so many ideas that are just constantly kind of like tumbling out of him. And him coming from the world of like SNL, you know, he's kind of one to really just come up with stuff on the spot. And I love that. I love just like thinking and responding. And yeah, he throws me some curveballs sometimes, and it's like very terrifying. But, you know, because you're just, you have no idea. You kind of just have to reach into the void. And that's when being well-versed in your character, where you kind of just like put on that skin, and then you just live in it and you respond as it. But yeah, it's crazy. It's very terrifying.
So does it come naturally for you, how to respond as NoHo Hank?
It is, yeah. I mean, I think it took, because I fortunately had like a few months to build this character from the ground up, and, you know, went to acting school for all that stuff. So it's like I was, you know, incorporating all of these different, you know, techniques, like animal techniques, where you kind of make your character based on an animal and then like build it back. And, you know, just I built like a whole life for this guy. And so I'm really attached to him.
I feel like I've seen some of those animal exercises.
Yes.
From Kustenau.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
That's actually on the show, there's an actor's studio.
Oh, for sure. I know that world very well. Absolutely.
So it's kind of a parody of that, if you know the world. Is
yes.
that right?
Oh, okay. Totally. I mean, and what's cool, too, is that, like, you know, it's really fun to kind of, like, laugh at that world because it's so ridiculous. But it also makes sense that Barry is so drawn in to kind of that world because, you know, if anyone who's taken an acting class realizes that, wow, this is like a real family, it's a real community. You actually feel like you're part of something. And those bonds that you create, it's, you know, it's incredible.
And it occurs to me that some acting requires elements of therapy. There's talk about kind of Barry opening his wound and how you're supposed to open your wounds.
Yes.
In acting to kind of get closer to a character.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, acting is all about relatability and finding empathy for a character, which is essentially kind of, you're finding empathy with a part of yourself, which is a part of a character that was written by someone else,
mm-hmm.
which was essentially kind of a part of them as well, because it was a voice in their head they wrote down. And then so you're kind of, you know, experiencing empathy through a character, through this person who wrote the character, with another actor who's doing the exact same thing with their character. So, you know, I could probably draw you a diagram. Probably make
this is
it
getting
easier.
Very meta.
Very meta, exactly. I know. But yeah, but getting back to your question, I think, you know, you kind of do have to go deep.
Time for a break. When we come back, how Anthony grappled with a condition that he was told would derail his acting career. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR and the following message come from VSP Individual Vision Plans, offering coverage for a low monthly cost if you don't have vision coverage through an employer. You'll get access to the nation's largest network of independent doctors and hundreds of name brand frames. Plus, you can save more than $200 a year. VSP believes you deserve to see better for life for less. Discover for yourself at needvspcoverage.com.
Hey there, before we get back to the show, here's a podcast for you to check out this month. Ask Me Another is celebrating women in comedy every Friday in April. You'll hear Russian Doll star Greta Lee, who I hope you heard on this show recently, along with the show's co-creator Leslie Headland, plus Retta from NBC's Parks and Recreation, and more to come. Women in comedy all this month on Ask Me Another from NPR. For our audience that can't see you, you have a certain look.
I do.
No hair, no eyebrows, no eyelashes.
Yep.
But you didn't come to Hollywood with this appearance.
No.
Tell us about your journey and what happened.
Yeah, so I have alopecia.
Mm-hmm.
That's an autoimmune condition. I don't like to say disease because I don't feel like I'm diseased. So it's a condition. And it's like your immune system is confused. So it attacks the hair follicles, and so your hair falls out. And I know I had it since I was 3 years old, and it would just kind of affect whenever I would just have like patches that would fall out. And then at a certain point, it progressed, you know, to kind of all of my hair falling out. And when I started acting, I just had spots. And so I went into this industry just being like, I can keep a lid on this thing. No one has to know about it. I can just cover it up. It'll be fine. And it was really stressful because when it did start to kind of come out, it was actually during a series that I was on.
Wow.
And I lost like half my hair about halfway through in both eyebrows and most of my eyelashes. So we were just trying to kind of make me look how I used to look, you know, when I first started the series. And especially in an industry that is so much about image, I was so terrified that people were going to find out and that people were going to judge me and that people were going to reject me. And like, lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. I mean, people were just pretty mean and they were like, you're never going to work again. You're not as attractive anymore. You're just, you know, you're never going to get hired. I'm so sorry. You should probably think about something else to do.
Wow.
And on the one hand, I mean, it's sure it's terrifying to kind of hear someone say the thing that you're most afraid of, you know, but on the other hand, it's kind of liberating too, because once you hear it said out loud, you're like, oh, well, it's finally been said and I'm still here.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a process of real self-acceptance. And because, you know, I wouldn't have been able to kind of become what I am today if I didn't kind of accept myself completely. So, you know, unpacking all that shame and stuff took a lot of time, but it really just requires you standing in your own truth. Even if you can't see like the light at the end of the tunnel,
mm-hmm.
you just have to be in your own corner.
How did this change your career path? I mean, obviously you play two villains now, so
right.
I imagine you kind of get typecast as villains.
Yeah.
But did it change your offers in any way? Obviously your career has really taken off with Barry. But...
Yeah. Oh, it sure has. I mean, I had an idea that, you know, I mean, the bald guy just kind of plays the villain. Like, that's just one of those tropes. I think playing the villain is, in a lot of ways, way more fun than playing the hero. There's a lot more lessons in playing the villain than there is in playing the hero. I mean, the villain is essentially just kind of like a warped version of the hero. You know, they think that they're kind of doing what's right in their mind,
mm-hmm.
but, you know.
But playing a villain can easily become kind of cartoonish. So
yes.
How do you play a villain well?
Well, I think any villain has to be kind of rooted in humanity. You know, playing a villain well, I think, is just about understanding pain. And villains are essentially just living in a state of pain in which they can't really get out of or escape it. And so they're kind of responding with cruelty. But it's how the world has treated them. So it's like, can you blame them? Yes. Yeah, you can probably blame them. Absolutely. But...
Because there's a lot of torture and death and violence along.
Right. Because, yeah, it's like, no, never mind, kids. Don't empathize with the villain. But no, there's certainly a lot of lessons, though, that you can kind of learn from them.
I was telling one of the coworkers yesterday, NoHo Hank is coming in tomorrow. And then folks who didn't know who the character was, I said, he's the bad guy on Barry. And one of my coworkers goes, NoHo Hank isn't a bad guy. Which is to say
right.
that despite all the death and destruction, there is a heart there.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Hank, you know, for all that he's just kind of a happy-go-lucky guy this season, you see some new shades of him. And I think part of that's just because of the situation he's in. It's a very pressurized situation. He's kind of backed into a corner.
Mm.
And the darkness definitely comes out.
But it seems like you have this understanding that people are complex and people aren't bad, but our behaviors are bad or our reactions can be bad.
Yeah, it's when things kind of compound and life can just get to you. And it's, you know, everyone has their own story of where they're coming from and like,
sure.
you know, what they have going on and what they have on their plate. And it's an important exercise, too, to just be like, okay, this person's not being very nice to me. And rarely do we have the wherewithal to be like, okay, this person, the DMV, is like being awful to me. I actually love the women at the DMV. I mean, everyone at the DMV is great.
A big shout out to the women.
A huge shout out to the women at the DMV.
And California DMV.
Love them. Seriously. I went there on my birthday. It was great. Like, I had to go there on my birthday for my driver's license. They were so sweet. Yeah. So, you know, when someone's kind of going through something difficult, it's hard to take a step back. And actually just say, oh, okay, this person might be dealing with something really, really hard. So maybe I'll give them a break and not react, you know, negatively to them if they're treating me negatively. But it's hard.
Yeah.
You know, usually it just kind of like spreads like wildfire.
Right. Because you're reactive, then I'm reactive.
And then you take that and you kind of, you know, whatever.
Right.
Your barista like makes a mistake on your name. You're just like, whoa.
I just go with Benji.
Yeah, exactly.
Just always be Benji at Benji, Starbucks.
Right.
Nobody else is ever a Benji.
Right. Yes.
And you just have to remember that that's your Starbucks name.
Yes.
Because when they call it and you don't respond.
And you don't respond, then you're in trouble.
Right. It gives it away. And,
yes.
And you'll lose your coffee.
Okay, Benji. Nice.
Back to Hank real quick. You mentioned that Hank is getting darker in season two, or we're seeing his darker side. We're seeing his pain more. Will that lead the audience to not root for him as much? Because we're really on Hank's side with season one.
Well, I think the kind of beautiful thing about Hank is he he doesn't really, I don't know, he's kind of like a goldfish. He, you know, he can be one way and then like the next, in 5 minutes, he's like totally fine and
no
kind
memory.
Of back to normal. Yeah, he's like no memory. And so he's totally back to just being like a sweet, lovable goofball.
Okay, so we'll still love him.
I hope so. I hope so, yeah.
Time for one more break. In a minute, Anthony's path to LA and how he defines success after his breakout role in Barry.
Support for NPR and the following message come from WordPress.com. With powerful site-building tools and thousands of themes to choose from, WordPress.com lets their users pursue what they love by launching a site that's free to start with room to grow. Their customer support team is made of actual WordPress experts who are standing by to help you 24 hours a day, including weekends. And WordPress users own their content forever. Get 15% off any new plan purchase at wordpress.com/minute.
What does it take to turn an idea into reality, even when no one else believes you can? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with innovators about their influential brands and the stories behind them, the failures, triumphs, and everything in between.
Let's go back in time a little bit. You grew up outside of Boston.
Yep.
Do you remember catching the acting bug?
Yeah, I mean, kind of. I started acting when I was a little kid.
Little were you?
I was like 8, 9 years
wow.
old. But not you know, professionally. It's just kind of children's theater.
Mm-hmm.
And I was such a shy kid. Like I really had a hard time opening up. I would always wear a hat just like below my brow and no one could really see my eyes. And I was just spoke very quietly. And it was when I kind of got on stage that I actually felt like I could come out of my shell a little bit. And it was through, you know, playing characters and dressing up and just kind of being silly that I felt like I could kind of express myself in this way. So it was really cool. I really loved that.
It's interesting to me, though, to hear that you were a shy kid who liked acting, because typically, if you're shy, you don't want to put yourself in front of people and perform on stage. So did your parents encourage you to do this to help overcome your shyness? Or did you find that you liked it after you learned that it helped you?
I think that, my parents were certainly very, very supportive. And
they had to sign you up for these things.
Yeah, they had to sign me up for it. And I think, you know, I was kind of surprised by it that, like, I actually liked doing it. I think I was just very scared as a kid. You know, I was very worried that I was just going to, you know, whatever, embarrass myself or something.
You ended up, so from theater as an elementary school student all the way through to college, you studied drama
mm-hmm.
at Carnegie Mellon.
Yep.
How did you get there from the East Coast out here to L.A.?
Yeah, I mean, okay, so did the children's theater thing, and then did Shakespeare camp over the summers.
Okay.
Yeah, Project Shakespeare, which is amazing. It's out of New Hampshire now, but it was in Boston. And, I went to Carnegie Mellon, had a blast there. And once I graduated, I actually, you know, I had representation immediately. I was very kind of fortunate in that regard. And I worked in New York for a few years doing theater and Law and Order. Did my time on
Law and
Order.
Had to do Law and Order.
Had to do it. I had to do it.
Who were you on Law and Order?
I was the bad guy, obviously.
But your condition really hadn't gotten serious by then, right? You still were.
Yeah, it had.
You still had hair on your head.
I still had hair. I had actually like very long hair. But I still had.
You still got cast as a bad guy.
I still got cast as a bad guy, exactly. I think starting out in New York was great because I feel like they. You know, not a lot of actors will just move to New York to be famous. That's not, you know, they move to New York because they're like, okay, I really want to see if I can do it. Whereas, you know, Los Angeles people kind of move here a lot of the time too.
To make
you know,
it.
To make it, yeah, but also to be famous, you know, and to be a celebrity.
And you see them as two different things.
I think so, yes. Yeah, I think, you know, when you're...
Tease that out for me. What's the difference between making it for you and then being famous?
When you're trying to make it, I think you're really challenging yourself because you're playing really difficult characters with maybe a lot more challenging material. And to be able to kind of hang in with really seasoned actors, with really amazing people, and to kind of, you know, actually work is, you know, that's a testament. Whereas I think when someone wants to become a celebrity, they care more about, you know, the red carpet and being a personality. And, you know, all that stuff is fine, but I so prefer just to kind of work and have fun and bring characters to life. You know, nothing wrong with the red carpet. It's fine.
Talk a little bit about that, because you found yourself at your first Emmys last year.
I did.
What was that like?
It was nuts. It's
did huge. You feel like you had made it?
I don't know. It's kind of a strange metric to kind of be like, oh, I've made it. I've arrived. I can relax now, you know? But it's crazy, though. It's crazy doing the red carpet scene and having to come up with answers and have that kind of spotlight put on you. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's fun.
So you just said that this doesn't give you a sense of arrival, like, hey, I've arrived. Is there a marker for you, a place that you're kind of getting to as you charge up the hill? I imagine you feel like you haven't gotten there yet. So what's your next goal?
I don't know. I mean, that's actually probably something I should really come to terms with myself.
What are my goals?
Yeah, what are my goals? Let's hash it out right now. Do you guys have a notepad?
Yeah.
Well, I think...
We got time.
Yeah, exactly. I think you don't ever want to, like... Just be like, okay, I made it. Now I can coast, you know? I feel like that's kind of just giving up. I want to continue to kind of push the envelope. I want to continue to kind of create fun characters and do different things and make dynamic choices.
And I imagine you've established some good relationships with the people that you're working with now that will also stay in the business. So
yes.
These things kind of become a cycle.
It is. Yeah, it's so cool. And with each of those things, I mean... The bonds that you form in an acting class or you know, doing a play mm-hmm. or doing a movie or a TV series, like, you know, it's like having a family. And then all of a sudden it's like, you know, when that thing kind of ends, you all kind of disperse, but you stay really good friends with these people. Mm. And then all of a sudden it's like you see them again on another project
yeah.
in a different kind of costume, in a different light after many years or something. And it's really cool to kind of just keep seeing all of your peers, you know, dipping in and out of your life in a, you know, in a professional setting.
Did we get to how you ended up coming to LA? What shifted in your mind that led you to come out here?
It wasn't even like a shift in that.
Temperament.
It was actually just kind of with work. I was like, when I get a job that brings me out here, I will. And that's kind of what happened. It was like my first series. And it was actually the series that all my hair started falling out.
Mm.
So, yeah, it was pretty surreal. That was my first introduction to Los Angeles, was being like super stressed and having all my hair fall out.
And it taught you a lot, right? I imagine. So one question that I have for you about this journey that you've been on and coming out here and then losing all your hair on the big job that you moved out here for.
Yeah.
Is what have you learned about yourself? This is a place where, and an industry where image consciousness is a big deal, appearance matters. What have you learned about self-acceptance?
I mean...
And just being comfortable in your own skin, because that's something I think we all deal with, irrespective of whether we're actors.
Right. Well, first of all, it's a practice. It's amazing how much we kind of get down on ourselves. And the way that we talk to ourselves, it's like you would never talk to anyone like that. Hmm. And yet we find ourselves talking to, you know, to ourselves in a way that's so demoralizing and just belittling and mean. And it's like, why do that? You wouldn't treat anyone that way. So kind of envision yourself as your best friend. And yeah, that really, I mean, it's amazing once you kind of really start to champion yourself, that you start to see, you know, you start to see the world in a different light, and you start to kind of see that, oh, wow, no, I can do this.
Okay, real quick, before we let you go, how do you do the hey, man? Will you teach it to me?
Yes, okay. Yes, absolutely. Okay, so real quick, it's, you want to, like, deliver a k sound with the hey. So, hey, man, you know, hey,
Kit.
Yeah, no, that's it. That's it. You got it.
Hey, Barry.
Yeah. Barry.
Barry. Hey, Barry.
Yeah, Barry. Okay, Barry. Barry's my best friend. Yeah, it's funny. You know, once I kind of start to get into NoHo Hank, it's hard to kind of put him down.
Anthony Carrigan, I so enjoyed our conversation.
This was great. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much to Anthony Carrigan. Barry Season 2 is on Sunday nights on HBO. Listeners, I'm in the host chair again this week for our weekly wrap on Friday. If you want to be part of that episode, please don't forget to share the best thing that's happened to you all week. To do that, record yourself and email the audio file to the show at samsanders@npr.org. samsanders@npr.org. You might hear it in Friday's episode. Until then, I'm Elise Hu. Thanks for listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. For the better of your soul, we gotta change our love. Change our love. We gotta change for the world.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Bombas. Bombas makes absurdly soft socks, underwear, and T-shirts. And for every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness. Get 20% off your first purchase at bombas.com/NPR and use code NPR. Support for NPR and the following message come from Sattva. Sattva luxury mattresses are every bit as elegant as the most expensive brands, but because they're sold online, they're about half the price. Visit SAATVA.com/NPR and save an additional $200.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.